In helping applicants access resources, you know from the funding mechanisms course last 2 weeks ago where a variety of technical resources are for infrastructure. We talked about cooperative agreements when you are able to commit your time and expertise or get the expertise of other NIH experts, say, intramurally to work cooperatively with applicants. Research grant initiatives, RFAs. Now, we did a training a couple of years ago called Initiative Writing 101 that we put in one place the steps and checkoffs that you go through for developing an initiative, who you consult, who signs off, your interaction with grants management. That training is on streaming video, and the training materials are available to you. And instead of spending more time here on initiative development, I would suggest that you go to that training and those documents. R&D contracts, again, as we talked about in funding mechanisms, when you know what you need and have a clear enough understanding of the science and the potential for filling in the blanks in science, then that you can write a statement of work, then you can go to contracts. As Dennis was saying, there are other organizations that do research funding that investigators aren't always looking at. There's the specific disease foundations, American Heart, Juvenile Diabetes, Cancer Association. There's private fellowships, funding agencies for fellowships like the Anna Fuller Fund that can also support research and training that aren't strictly from your domain, but you're in the funding business. It's part of your duties to know where other resources are. Helping fund the research in your portfolio, you may want to work to establish interagency agreements or cooperatively with other institutes to expand sponsorship of RFAs. You may seek more actively to help ensure that applications that cross between institutes get secondary assignments in case pay lines at another institute for supporting your work in your portfolio may also overlap portfolios at other institutes and increase the applicant's chance of being funded. You can, as long as you're doing that before the date of the review meeting to get those assignments, date of the councils to get those assignments shared, then that will increase that applicant's chances. You should know quite a bit about how to work with your grants management staff. One thing that I did early on in my career was I spent a couple of weeks with the grants management staff that were assigned to my portfolio so that I understood their job and what they did and how I would interact specifically with them. And we'll get into more of this in the part four of the core curriculum, the staff interactions. If you want to grow your portfolio and not at the expense of someone else's portfolio, and you need to develop your scientific area, you can see the opportunities. You have very little power working alone as a program official unless you get the confidence and feedback and support of your branch chiefs and your division directors and ultimately your institute director. And the culture at different institutes is different in this regard. In some cases, you can simply walk into your institute director's office and share ideas. In some institutes, that's much harder to do. You can work with your advisory councils in council discussions. See through portfolio analysis potentials for expanding the scope, drilling down in areas of research that your institute can support. as Dennis mentioned, sending PIs to sister institutes that can also share interest in what they do. On review appeals, we'll probably spend more time on this if next year you take the ESA seminars. Grounds for appeals are not the same as rebuttals, which is a process we don't do anymore, but for appeals of inappropriate review or inappropriate budget cutting, you should study the manual chapter 54120, which is a link that's in the outline when you go online to look at this, for how to advise applicants and how to help them address problems that may have occurred either in review or in the budget recommendation for their application. Which brings us to this other part of your job. There's the science side, portfolio development, looking out for where the taxpayers' interests in terms of the science are. But there's a whole other section of your administrative job, which Dennis and Lubisha alluded to. And this is helping the applicants with the policy side. And I think Jamie has a slide set that we can go to for this.
Okay. That's good.
You can go forward with these arrow buttons, the space bar at this
point. Okay, thanks. I'm Jamie Biswas. I'm a branch chief in the Division of Pharmacotherapies and Medical Consequences of Drug Abuse at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and I've been a program official there about 15 years. I'd just like to ask how many people here are in program? And in review? Oh. And grants management? One grants management? And contracts management? Okay. I feel that as a program official that my job is a daily work in progress. And the reason is because every day something happens that could be that's unexpected or a problem comes up or whatever. And I think you're going to find that, too. I don't know how long you've been at your job, but at least you know you'll never be bored. And even though you have specific responsibilities within your job, you'll find that those responsibilities and obligations overlap a lot with review and with grants management. And if you do contracts, a lot with contracts. The contracts management branch in your institution. In fact, I find that I've spent an enormous amount of time with contract management officials and grants management officials trying to learn why they have to do things the way they have to do them. Because if you don't understand that, then you're not going to be able to understand how the funding process works or exactly what to do when issues do arise. So you have a responsibility, which you share with grants, and I should have put contract management officials in there as well, to assure the proper stewardship of federal grant funds and contract funds. And you have specific responsibilities regarding the technical part of the grants, and also a little bit of the money, although most of the money issues are taken care of by grants management. And another thing I like to do, I love going to grants management courses just for grants management officials, because it takes a really long time to learn how they operate and how they do the things they have to do. So I was surprised once when I invited a PI to come to our institute and give a seminar, and I introduced him And I said, I'm his, Dr. X's program official. And he said, well, she's really more like my parole officer. And I'm hoping it was a joke. I think it was a joke. But the thing is, I think NIH really does try to be very flexible when problems come up, and problems come up with almost every grant. But as Carlos was saying earlier, there are policies and guidelines, and we have to work with those. I myself am a chemist. Do we have any other chemists here? Yeah. Well, you know, as a chemist, that you're always talking about how atoms have certain degrees of freedom within a molecule. And those degrees of freedom are dependent upon the structure of the molecule. So as a program official, you have certain flexibilities that you can work with the grantees on, but you can't stray from the infrastructure. You can't stray from the policy. And no matter how long I've known a grantee, I try not to be too friendly, because in the end, I'm going to have to stick to policy. So people know that even though I've known them for 15 years, if they want to talk to me about their review, then I'm not going to talk to them until they have their summary statement. I'm just not. I don't want to give anybody the feeling that they're getting special favors, because at NIH, we have to ensure a level playing field. We ensure it for the reviews of grants and for the administration of grants. And if we do one thing for one person, we got to do it for the other person, or be prepared to do it for another person. And even if people are totally obnoxious, I have to do as much for them as I do for the ones who are friendly, because they don't got to love me and I don't got to love them. Okay? And I think it's just better to keep it kind of professional like that. So one thing you do is you monitor the progress. If it's a contract, you have deliverables, and you can insist on the progress, because the deliverable is why you purchase the contract in the first place. But for a grant, it's kind of tough, because you don't have to prove the hypothesis of your grant to keep getting the funds. I mean, as long as they're trying, you can't really cut them off. And science is very difficult, and you don't know the difficulties that you're going to get into when you start a project. But one thing the grantee is more in control of, they're not so much in control of the science, but they can control their own budget. And they have to be careful with how they spend their funds. They can't burn through them at twice the rate they're supposed to and then think they're going to be able to get a supplement. On the other hand, if they're working with a medication or suddenly have to buy a piece of equipment they need to in order to complete the project, then, you know, there is a good basis there for applying for a supplement and getting a bit more grant money. I think that monitoring the budget is one of the toughest things, because there are things that we have to do and things that we can be flexible about. Stuff happens, okay? The PI suddenly decides to move or get sick or dies. There's a hurricane. We had a case where one of the key personnel murdered somebody and went to jail, so nothing got done on the grant for about 18 months because he was so difficult to replace. He was very highly trained. What do you do? You don't want to terminate the grant. And so they need to contact grants management when there's going to be a change, and they need to contact you as well, and they need to tell you. So if they're going to move, they need to tell you ahead of time. I've had grantees who've moved, called me up and said, well, you know, I moved. And I said, when did you move? Oh, a month ago, and I need my grant now. Well, what did you do before you moved? I don't know. Don't you guys just give me my grant? And like you learned earlier this morning, a grant belongs to the grantee organization, doesn't belong to the PI, and he didn't know that. And he didn't understand that a grant is a contract between the grantee organization and the PI, and that's why they both sign the face page. And that's why when they want to ask for something or report on something, they have to send a countersigned letter signed by both the PI and the business official. Otherwise, grants management's going to send it flying right back to them. They're not going to accept it. So it was very difficult for him, because it took a while to transfer that grant, because the grantee organization has to agree to transfer it. And if they don't want to, they can choose a new PI. But you, as program people, have the right to say, well, you don't want that PI. You know, you want the old PI or no grant. And then they might relinquish it. You might say, well, you do have a good point there. You still have a good program there. The PI's moved someplace where there really isn't an infrastructure where he can keep that research going. You can appoint a new PI. And that's going to be your decision, okay, in conjunction with grants management. You also have to make decisions about carryover funds. When they send in their progress report, which should be a good report, it should tell you, it doesn't need to be a lot of detail, but they need to tell you what they did. They can't just send in a paragraph. You also look and see if they have any carryover funds. There's a part in the PHS 2590, which is the Type 5 non-competing continuation application, which says, do you intend to carry over more than 25% of the current year's total budget? If they're not restricted and they have under 25%, they can just carry it over. But if it's more than 25%, they have to tell you that they have this large carryover, and they have to tell you what they're going to do with it and why it happened. And then you and grants management together will decide whether or not you want to approve them keeping the funds. And you don't have to approve them keeping the funds. You can subtract the number of funds they're carrying over from the next year's grant budget and just give them the offset, which doesn't make people very happy. We ran an award for a dollar once because you hadn't spent any money in 2 years. So we offset it, and it was only – well, actually, we wanted to put in zero money, but the system wouldn't take it, so we had to put in a dollar. But I really don't like doing things like that. You know, things like this don't happen very often. And especially in the first year of a grant, it's hard to get up and running. You have to hire people. You got to get your postdocs. You got to buy equipment. They're probably not going to spend everything in the first year. And I don't like to offset grants for the following year because they're going to get to the end of the project period and they're going to need the money to finish. And they can always have a no-cost extension and finish in the last year, you know, have an extra year, but you don't need to put money in it, you know, because they still have money left over because they never got started off the mark in year one. So you have to think of all these things. Now, if a grant's in its second year and they're still not spending, then you have to look into it. Because once your institute obligates that money for the year, it's gone from your program. And if the grantee doesn't use it and the grant terminates, it's just going to go back to the treasury. But it's not going to go back to your institute. Okay, so you've lost it. You don't want to get to the end of a grant period and have put in 3 or 4 years' worth of money and not have them spend it or have done anything. So these are the questions you need to juggle with, and it's really worthwhile discussing with your division director and your grants management officials what you should do in these cases. Supplement requests, I already mentioned that. Supplement money in our institute is always a separate pot of money. And if somebody gets their grant cut, you really shouldn't say to them, don't worry, you can apply for a supplement, because it doesn't mean that they're going to get it. But there's usually a discretionary supplement fund that each institute has that you can help a grantee out if they find themselves short of money and not able to finish the project and they have a really good justification for needing it. You're also responsible to oversee the protection of human subjects as best you can. Of course, you don't know what's going on. Unless, even if you go there in site visit, you're not going to know what's going on. But you're the ones who are going to be approving the final data and safety monitoring plan. You're the ones who are going to make a decision as to whether a data and safety monitoring board is necessary, and you need to read the reports of that board and any IRB reports that come out in case of adverse events. And you need to make a decision if you think the project is getting too risky that you don't want to fund it anymore. And again, I'm coming up against something that like that right now where it looks very risky and we might want to terminate the project. You're also responsible that the grantee has the assurances for the appropriate care and use of animals. Of course, grants management isn't going to run any notice of grant award without the proper assurances and clearances and IACUC letters or IRB letters in place. But during the life of the project, you read the progress reports, you review adverse events, you want to see that nothing adverse is happening. Data sharing, oh, this is something that's been very, very difficult with the grantees. They don't understand the policy. They don't understand what they're supposed to write in their grant application, and they don't understand why they have to do it. And what I say to them is, look, if it's really not possible to share your data until the end of the project, okay. Otherwise, you might want to look into putting your data into a communal database, if there is one. You're not trying to let other people beat you to the punch. You're just trying to share the data. And I think there's a lot of courses and seminars at NIH about this, and I encourage you to go to them. I'm not going to get into it in detail today. Invention reporting also necessary. Grants management gets very upset if grantees don't report their inventions. So in my division, we have a mission to develop medications for substance use disorders. So all the grants that I deal with are clinical trial grants. And when I inherited this job a couple years ago, I suddenly found myself having to take on responsibilities for the protection of human subjects. And these are all the things you have to do in pre-award. IRB approval has to be in place, but grants management, as I say, is going to look after that. If the summary statement got a code 44, that means there's human subjects concerns. You have to work together with the PI to address that and get all the documentation necessary over to Carlos's office so they can decide whether or not the bar can be lifted. You can still run the award, but it's going to be restricted. They won't be allowed to use and do anything involving human subjects until that bar has been lifted. You've got to decide if a data and safety monitoring plan is going to be needed for all clinical trials. You have to decide if it's acceptable. You have to, as I said before, you have to decide if there's a need for a board. And if there should be restrictive language in the NGA, if you're worried about the risk of the project or whatever, you can say in the NGA, you know, in the event of a serious adverse event, we're going to do this, that, and the other thing. So the data and safety monitoring plan, this has come as a result of this notice in the guide that came out in 2000. And it doesn't, for the grant application itself, it doesn't really have to be very detailed because it's not a review issue. It's an administrative issue. But if you decide to fund the grant, at that point, you're going to have to ask the PI to provide you with a detailed plan. And it should have everything in it, not just for the safety monitoring, but for the data monitoring. And a lot of people are turning in plans where they're very clear about the safety monitoring, but they don't say anything about how they're going to monitor the data. And that's another important part of it and another thing to remember. And this is just the PHS 398 instructions. I'm not going to go through them because they're very clear about how you develop your plan. The plan is actually a strategy whereby the PI is going to periodically evaluate the validity and integrity of the data and the safety of the trial. And each institute is allowed to decide for themselves just how they're going to do the monitoring with these plans. And at NIDA, what we've decided is, like I say, we put sample plans on the website. We have a decision tree. Here's our decision tree that one of our medical officers put together to help people understand whether or not they're going to need a plan. And we have very detailed instructions on how to write it. And we insist that before a program official can approve a plan, that they give it to one of our medical officers for their review. So we're very kind of picky about this because I think a lot of our trials do entail a great deal of risk. We have patients getting IV cocaine administration and things like that, and you have to be very, very careful when you're doing research of that type. Do they need a board? We've decided that for human lab studies involving IV administration of illegal drugs, that they should always have a board, even if there's only five people in the trial, because we think that there's the possibility of a risk. For some of the trials that you do in your institutes, that probably wouldn't be necessary. For a large trial, you should have a board. So we have guidelines that we wrote in there for a board as well. And a lot of the grantees feel that, oh, no, this is going to be a huge expense for me. But it's not. It's not a big deal to have a board. You can have three or four people from your institute, as long as they're not being paid off the grant, have them on the board. They don't have to meet all the time. They can meet twice a year. That's plenty. That's fine, depending on what kind of trial they're doing. So I think it's a very good safety valve to have in place for most of the trials that we have, and it's something that you need to decide if you need. And this is just the format of how we want the board plan to go. And so on to contracts. I just am going to say a few words about contracts, because our division does a lot of contracts, because we're supposed to be developing medications to treat substance use disorders. And we do that through the only two ways you can do things at NIH, and that's through grants and contracts. And we have the contracts actually in place to help the grantees, because the grantees can't possibly cover every facet of drug development with their grant. Otherwise, every grant would be millions of dollars. So we have contracts in place to do testing for them. We do preclinical testing and clinical testing. Purpose of a contract is to purchase effort, goods, or services. As the program official, you got to write the request for a contract and the statement of work and delivery schedule, and you have to decide very clearly what you want your deliverables to be. You don't want to be too restrictive, because then it could happen that the contractor can't deliver. But you don't want to be too loose about it, because then there could be all kinds of loopholes there for the contractor not to deliver what you want. You're going to monitor the technical progress just like you do for a grant. You're going to look after the money by reviewing and approving invoices, and you're going to do technical evaluations. And for contracts, I usually end up doing a lot more site visits than I do for grants, just because it's such specific, particular work. And, of course, you want to work closely with your contracting officer, not just to resolve budgetary issues, but, you know, all kinds of issues that come up with a contract. Like, if this is an example of the kind of contracts we have in our division. We're supposed to be a soup-to-nuts kind of division, where we do everything from drug design to phase three clinical trials to helping people get their INDs from the FDA. And to do this, we have an array of preclinical testing for binding assays and behavioral pharmacology, all the way through tox testing. Of course, before we get to the really expensive stuff like toxicity testing and safety pharmacology testing, we have to meet and weed out which grantee can have this resource, because we can't do it for everybody. So we have to meet regularly and decide who's making the best progress, who has the most important thing to prove that we would help them with, and which would be most helpful to NIDA to get a medication for whatever indication we need, because we don't have any medications for methamphetamine abuse or cocaine abuse. So, you know, those things would be higher up on our totem pole. Evaluating clinical data, we can also provide statistical analysis and database management for people. So this is just more specific of the type of contracts that we have. So I think, in closing, it's important that you just try and keep up with change, because the science changes, the NIH changes, the budgets change. And I think the best way to do this is just to keep taking courses and stay aware, keep aware of the policy changes. We get emails all the time. Go to the guide. It comes out every Friday. Go to the guide. Look at the new policy changes. Read the NIH grants policy statement when you got nothing to do, like during lunch or whatever. So it's really important. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in there. And keep talking to your grants, contracts, and review officials. They know a lot. You can learn a lot from them. And you want them to know who you are, too, you know, so they can come to you with an issue and keep you aware of it. because sometimes people contact them and they don't contact you. Or lots of times people will send you program things that they should have sent to grants management. And you have to be aware of that, that there may be something in your box or in your fax that really should go somewhere else for any action to happen. And have input. You know, you should join committees, not just within your own institute, but I think it's very important to join NIH-wide committees. I was on the SBIR committee for a long time. That was really, I learned a lot there, and I felt it was really very productive. And you may have the opportunity to make some changes, too.